With that, let us invite Michael Stewart to help us with the IFRS Interpretation Committee update.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. And I know I've met most of you before, but for any who I haven't, I'm Michael Stewart. I'm Director of Implementation Activities here at the ISB. And one of my main roles is looking after the work of the Interpretations Committee. So I wanted to give you an update as to what the committee has been doing recently in terms of its issues, particularly following on from the trustees' review of the effectiveness and efficiency of the Interpretations Committee. That review was concluded in March, and the report published in April, just highlighting the findings of that review. And I'm sure many of you will have responded to the trustees when they issued their questionnaire originally to make that assessment. Now, one of the things that came out of that was that the both the ISB and the Interpretations Committee felt that they wanted to be helpful and to be more active in addressing issues that are submitted to it. Now, that's something that wasn't just something that happened in March, but it was something that was building over a while. And so what I wanted to do today was just to highlight how that has manifested itself in terms of the work that the committee is doing. I prepared some slides because I just thought that would be the easiest way to talk through some of these issues. And on slide two, I've got a summary there of the current activity that the committee is working on. My intention is not to go into the technical details of many of these issues, but really just to give a flavour for what it is that the committee is doing. Now, in terms of current activity, we've got two draft interpretations that were published over the last 6 months that I've now had comment letters closed, and we're now in the process of looking at the comments received on those. One to do with accounting for levies, and which is sort of an expansion, if you like, of IFRIC 6, and a more sort of general look at the levies that companies need to pay, and particularly when to account for the liabilities under those arrangements. And the other draft interpretation related to put options written over non-controlling interests, and in particular there, the question about when the liability is recorded for those put options, whether the remeasurement of that liability should be recognised in profit or loss or through equity or perhaps some other comprehensive income. And those are two draft interpretations that have been issued lately. In addition to that, though, and this is sort of part of the expansion of the committee's work, it's started to do work where it's proposing amendments to standards, working with the board. So it'll analyse an issue, propose a solution to the ISB, and the ISB will then, after debating that and considering it, publish an exposure draft to propose a narrow scope amendment. And at the moment, we've got four exposure drafts which will be being published over the next few weeks through to the end of the year that have arisen out of these issues, each of these having come originally to the Interpretations Committee. These I see as being really part of the maintenance of IFRSs. Through the agenda consultation, we heard that a lot of work has been done over recent years in terms of developing new or major amendments to IFRSs, but perhaps now there needs to be some additional focus on the maintenance of standards. So I see this as being part of that additional focus on the maintenance of IFRSs. And these issues here that are listed, two of them to do with equity accounting, one to do with how to present the share of other changes in net assets in an investee. So there's changes in equity that don't go through P&L or OCI in the investee. Where should the investor present those? the equity account, the gain on recognition between the, when there's a transfer of assets between the investor and the investee, there's a long-standing conflict between guidance in IAS 27 and later on IFRS 10 compared with the guidance in SIC 13, which has now been incorporated into IAS 28. Should it be full gain recognition or partial gain recognition? And the other items, there's purchase of interest in a joint operation. How should one account for that when there's a business included in that joint operation? Should you apply an IFRS 3 type approach, or should it be more of a cost-based approach? And the fourth one there to do with clarifying whether a revenue basis for depreciation is acceptable for PP&E or intangible assets. Now, those are issues which have, as I say, been long-standing issues. And I think when we're looking at issues to take on and the board is considering projects to address, we also look at cost-benefit trade-offs. And I think, and I've said this before when we were consulting on the agenda a year or so ago, that you know, when we're looking at amendments that we should be making to IFRSs, yes, we want to improve financial reporting. And one of the areas that the Interpretations Committee is particularly interested in is improving financial reporting where there's diversity of practice at the moment. So by reducing that diversity of practice, so we're improving financial reporting. But the other thing that I think is always worth thinking about is how can amendments that we make to the standards to add more clarity, to add guidance where there isn't guidance at the moment, by doing that, remove uncertainty associated with how to apply a standard in a particular situation, and by removing the uncertainty, hopefully reduce the costs of applying IFRSs. So the equity accounting issues are, I think, good examples of ones where there's been diversity in practice because either standard has been clear or it hasn't given particular guidance. And so it can be very easy for companies, preparers, and also auditors as well to spend time and effort debating these issues, discussing what's the appropriate treatment. And if we're able to remove the uncertainty through proposing an amendment through one of these narrow scope amendments, then that's an additional benefit I see to making the amendments to the IFRSs. So those are the four exposure drafts.
Do you want to take questions at this time? Because Malcolm is biting at the...
Well, yes. I mean, the issue is there have been at times when you've issued interpretations that people have said, well, it's so clear you should always have been doing that. So you actually end up accounting for it more or less as an error. And so what's the view with some of these changes? Is it prospective? If you're clarifying something, is it prospective accounting, or is it a change in accounting policy, or is it just saying, well, it was so obvious you've got to account for it as an error?
Okay. Well, certainly we don't and we won't say that something is so obvious it must have been an error. And we said that as part of our review of the Interpretations Committee, that we don't see that it's our place to tell a company that its past accounting was an error. What we should do is to clarify the standards, to make it clear how the standards should be applied in a particular circumstance, and to focus on that. Whether it should be prospective or retrospective, we are, in these circumstances, looking at changing the standards. So whenever we're changing the requirements of the standard, then we do stop and think about, would it be most appropriate to give transition guidance to say, look, you should do this prospectively, or do we think that, no, actually, the information is likely to be available, and so therefore, because the information's we think is readily available, then for improving comparability on a sort of year-on-year basis, then we would recommend a retrospective application. But each of these is about changing the requirements of IFRSs. And so if a company is changing the way it accounts for something as a result of this, then it, I think, is very reasonable for it to say, look, we're changing because the ISB has concluded that what was there before wasn't clear enough and needs to be amended, and so this is now the way in which all companies should be accounting for that particular issue.
So I was actually jumping forward a little bit to the one on contingent pricing of PPE, for example. I mean, if you do something there, that might well be a fundamental change to how people are accounting for it today. So exactly. To my mind, it's a change. Very often, you're making a fundamental change to the standard, not just interpreting.
Sorry, but I'd have to say, I was interested in the revenue-based appreciation, but I presume that that would be come under accounting estimate rather than accounting methodology, because you're still depreciating. I would hope that one. That's what I would look at, I think.
Indeed. Whilst there's a change to the standard being proposed there, the change is about clarifying how one should make those estimates about depreciation. So I think that would be a reasonable interpretation to take. And with changes to estimates, those are always prospective, not retrospective.
Sorry, Michael. I have a dichotomy here. I'm getting lost at. At the beginning of the day, you weren't here, and we were told that the SEC said that the ISB needs to get more involved in enforcing. But when you pass a comment that said, as Malcolm said, it's so clear, it's obvious. I understand on draft interpretations they wouldn't be errors, but if it's so clear, it's obvious, then someone's got to stand up and say, it is an error. You can't be this politically correct if you're going to adopt this an enforcing approach.
And clearly we've got guidance about how to account for something when it is an error. So ISA will give you clear guidance as to what to do if you've had an error.
I'm saying we're not going to issue any guidance because it's obvious. Well, then it's obvious that it's an error. Because if it's obvious, it's obvious. And if you're not on the obvious page, you're in error.
Well, on your comment about sort of ISB getting involved with enforcement, we are very much not going to get involved in enforcement. There are those, securities regulators who have that particular role and responsibility. And yes, we want to be supportive of them, just as we would be supportive of preparers in preparing financial statements, supportive to them in the way that we can, because clearly consistent application of IFRS's, which, it's a whole sort of chain of events that is involved in leading to consistent application of standards. There's the writing of the clear standards, there is the preparation of financial statements, applying those standards in a sort of even-handed and balanced way. There's the obligations or responsibility of the auditors to check that, and there's the responsibility of the enforcers as well to enforce the requirements where they're not being met. So clearly there's a number of parties all with some role to play in ensuring consistent application of IFRS's, and we want to be supportive of those other parties who have those other roles, but we're not trying to get involved and don't want to get involved in those other stages, including the enforcement stage.
No, I'm on page that you don't want to get into that prosecution enforcement stage, but if something's clear, then the answer should come out. It's clear. And it's an error.
I think you see the letter that we wrote
to the Greek,
yeah.
Perfect example.
So I think I think it's a delicate balance. We got to walk a tight rope there, but I think I completely endorse what Michael Stewart just said. But I think it's a tight rope, and I think you will see one point that might be relevant in that SEC report is that clearly there's a very unequivocal comment that IASB should increase its interpretation process and more guidance and things like that. I think we are doing that. Mm-hmm. The only thing is that I'm just thinking whether how you can achieve the remaining slides in the next 12 minutes.
Okay. And that's fine. And I wanted to talk more about this whole approach rather than necessarily go into detail on these, although I'm happy to do so. We do, for a couple of years now, whenever we've had a submission into the Interpretations Committee, we have written to National Accounting Standards Centres to get input from them about how widespread an issue is and to what extent there's diversity in practice on an issue. And from the start of this year, we've also written to securities regulators to get, again, feedback from them on the same point. The reason I raise that is because, Kevin, if something is so clear that, you know, it's obvious what companies should have been doing, then we would expect to get feedback from standard setters and regulators that there isn't diversity in practice, everybody's doing it the same way, in which case we don't need to do anything with that. If they do come back to say there is diversity in practice, then even though, you know, I personally might read the standard and think, oh yes, I can see how that should be accounted for, clearly there are other ways in which you could reasonably read it, because there are many companies reading it in different ways, and auditors also. So it's, we try to tread a careful path through those sorts of situations.
Michael, can I ask you something? I didn't ask you beforehand, so you might, I don't want to put you on the spot. But when it comes to implementation and interpretation questions, if you broadly take the number of submissions we get, what percentage would that be from preparers?
That's a good point, and I was going to raise that, actually. I don't have statistics to hand, but it's a small minority that we get submissions from preparers. And that's why I wanted to raise the point about, you know, that I see this justification in addressing issues where there's lack of clarity or lack of guidance, where actually it's going to, by addressing the diversity in practice, we're also cutting out the costs involved in preparing financial statements, having debates with auditors, etc. Those, I think, are valid benefits that can be brought through in you know, the narrow scope amendments or annual improvements that we might want to do with some of these things. So, yes, I would be very happy to see more of our submissions coming from companies.
Can I just ask why that would be the case? If that's my personal understanding, too, is that we get very few submissions from the preparer. Is it because you guys think everything is all right? I'm not looking at Kevin, per se, but you don't want to bell the cat? What's the story?
Wait, where are you? Sorry.
Sorry?
The auditors don't let you. You've got to clear it through their London desk and their ISB desk, and you not, if you try and approach the regulator independently, the auditors go ballistic.
Well, yeah, there's partly, and there's a timing issue as well. I'd like to know, where are you getting the requests from then? If you, I mean, I'm unlike...
We grant anonymity to all submitters, and that's the standard. So, you know, please also take that away as well. That, you know, now, and so therefore I'm limited as to sort of too much detail, but one of the things that we do see is that when national standards setters, national accounting standards setters and securities regulators submit an issue, they waive their right to anonymity. They want to be known. And so you'll see actually there's quite a number of submissions over the last 6 months have come through those routes, particularly the national accounting standard setters. So we've had ones from Germany, from Canada, from Indonesia, from Malaysia. So that's often who is submitting them. Now, where they receive the issues from, whether it's them themselves or whether it is various stakeholders within their communities, I don't know. And to some extent, I don't need to know, actually, because what's important is the issue, not who it has come from.
What I would say is, touching on from what Kevin said, is one, as a preparer, I don't have 6 months to 2 years, 2.5 years to resolve an issue. Looking at the cycle of IFRIC solving an issue. So I'm not going to come along to IFRIC, even if the auditors, and I quite take a point, would let me do that or would be friendly to me afterwards, especially if we disagree. So I have to do it in a short order. I have to come to a solution which the auditors accept in very short order, be it their London desk or their New York desk. The other type of issue, if we're going to be characterised broadly, is diversity in practice. Now, if I found a solution that my auditors are satisfied with, I kind of stop. If there's diversity in practice, and I know of examples, if I go along to one of my peer group and they have got a different set of accounting that they've agreed with their different set of auditors, I'm not going to be able to change that because my set of auditors think one set of auditors are wrong. Kind of interesting if it's the same set of auditors with different solutions.
Well, I can give you that example.
Yeah, that's lots of fun. But that's a real politic of it. I have been in peer groups and pharmaceuticals and marketable owners where we do get together as a peer group to understand why things were different and how things, particularly on transition to IFRS, how we were doing the same. And I think that's probably the reason you don't get requests from prayers. One, you're not going to get a timely answer. Two, the auditors will hate you even more than they do anyway. And three, once you've got an answer agreed, why go back through the pain of reopening it?
Yeah. Now, and I completely understand that basis for why maybe companies aren't so often the submitters. One thing I would just say on the sort of the time scale that it takes to bring an issue through the Interpretations Committee and through to an amendment, I mean, you're right, you know, a couple of years would be about standard, maybe a little bit quicker if, you know, the wind was behind us. But having said that, some of these issues that we're dealing with at the moment are long-standing issues. So, you know, if there are things that you see in practice concerning the application of standards that you feel are troublesome and perhaps are not reflecting what you think would be the better accounting and relate to areas where you feel the standards are not clear or there's simply a lack of guidance, then, you know, yes, it might take 18 months, 2 years to take something from, you know, beginning to end, but it could still be worthwhile in terms of the medium term. Okay, the other slides that I prepared were highlighting or describing some of the larger issues that are on the committee's agenda at the moment that it's looking at. The committee is meeting tomorrow and Wednesday when we'll be discussing a number of these. And the reason for just including these in here was just to highlight the sorts of detailed issues that are being addressed at the moment. So we've got an issue about contribution-based promises, so picking up where D9 left off several years ago. Again, it's an issue that has continued to cause problems, and so we've decided to take another look at that. And the contingent pricing of PPE and intangibles, again, another long-standing issue, and one where there is no clear answer. The Interpretations Committee has discussed that one for quite a number of meetings, and there are very clearly a number of ways of looking at it. There's no obvious right answer because you could align with one piece of guidance to go one way or another piece of guidance to go another way. And right now I'm not quite sure where that one's going to go. It's going to be discussed over the next 2 days. We'll see where the committee decides to or where it lands in terms of the debating for that. Clearly it's something that at some stage should be addressed by the IASB. If we can do it in the sort of short to medium term through the committee, I think that would be very helpful. But it's a difficult issue, and a number of these are difficult issues, and they do take time to debate. Now, when the committee is debating these, it will tend, and certainly our staff analysis will tend to look at a number of different options. We'll identify those which we think are more consistent with the framework or the existing literature. But sometimes there's no clear answer, and actually getting a practical, pragmatic answer that can address diversity in practice is actually a worthwhile interim step to take. And that was the case with one of the equity accounting issues that we've dealt with. And I think the other issue, maybe just to spend the last few minutes...
you can go for 5 minutes extra.
Okay. I was going to say, the issue about going concern, and this is one which the submitter this time was the IAASB, the International Audit and Assurance Standards Board, who have asked for some clarification about what IFRS say about disclosures related to going concern. And this is all about when should, not about when should a company prepare financial statements on a going concern basis, but in circumstances where it is preparing financial statements on a going concern basis, but there are significant uncertainties associated with that going concern conclusion, when should disclosures be made about those uncertainties, and what disclosures should be given? And this is an area, it's been discussed for the first time at this week's meeting, and our proposals, our staff proposals, are that we should clarify the guidance, add some additional guidance in terms of what disclosures should be given. Now, this is one that I think would probably be best suited as a narrow scope amendment, so exposed separately rather than a part of annual improvements. But it's seen as being quite an important issue. Certainly IAASB is concerned that there has been some inconsistency in practice, and also perhaps companies not describing concerns or describing some of these uncertainties soon enough, and then companies having problems, running into problems without maybe investors being fully aware or as aware as they could have been about some of these going concern issues.
I have to say that when I saw that one, and you articulated it well, that was one of those areas where I couldn't see how that was an interpretation of a standard. You know, my principle is that the standard is written on the assumption that the business is a going concern. Okay, there's a reference to 12 months from the balance sheet date, which is beyond the UK. But all the standards are written on the basis that the business is a going concern. So I was, I take the point that I didn't see how that fitted within the remit.
When I read it, I thought you were getting involved in politics and that the auditors need a basis to qualify. Let's get out the IASB to issue that statement, because to me it's I won't use those words, but it's as Bill said, the statements are prepared and going concern. You either are or aren't. Just to say, look like a political argument, not a financial reporting position.
And certainly you're right, it's a binary decision. You either you are a going concern or you're not a going concern. And but for some companies it will be a difficult decision, and there'll be a grey area. And so obviously you've got to fall one side of the line or the other. And if you're falling the side of the line which says, actually, yes, I think I am going to continue in business appear on a going concern basis, but it's not been an easy decision to make, then the standard already says, you know, you need to be making some disclosures about those significant uncertainties, and it's about clarifying when those disclosures should be made.
Michael, if I may, I've actually on slide 7, I've actually almost come, I declare up front, I've come with a mandate to put you on the spot on the whole Swiss Business Committee.
He didn't tell me, so I can't help you there.
Here we are trying to, you know, we're actually putting in place IAS 19 revised from next year, and we're still talking about how to handle employee contributions. And I was at a meeting I was chairing with many of my Swiss peers last Friday, and there's still a lot of confusion about the appropriate, you know, so-called risk-sharing aspects of the standard. And to be honest, I mean, to put it bluntly, it's unacceptable that here we are 2 months away from implementing a new standard, and we still have lack of clarity how to handle this. So we need very quickly, I was hoping the next 2 days, the meeting in the next 2 days, guidance on actually how to handle risk sharing. It was portrayed as an issue. It basically relates to those situations where employees contribute and the contributions. The point is you've defined the net cost and not the gross cost. And the point is that quite often the employee's contribution increases as they get towards retirement age. So you actually have a different, the gross cost is always the same, but the net cost is different. And yet you're saying that the net cost should be spread across the whole pension period. And that means more complex actuarial calculations. And to be honest, we don't know how to handle it in Switzerland. We don't know, we have complete diversity in practice. You know, the actuaries say one thing, the auditors are not aligned. I'm speaking to my CFO and I said, here we are 2 months away, we're producing our budget. You can't tell me what to put in my budget for next year for service cost. It's unacceptable, actually. Sorry, I did declare my hand at the beginning.
You did. And I think I heard you mention earlier about that it's often only in the previous session it's only when you actually come to try to or start to apply the standards in practice that some of these difficulties become apparent. And, you know, because obviously our due process allows for, you know, exposure and comment and debate and that sort of thing through the process. But even so, there's still instances like this where it's when you come to try to apply it in practice that some of these things become apparent. Now, in this particular case, the actual concepts underlying the standard, it's not so much those that are in question, it's sort of how to apply them. And so what we've done with this particular issue in the staff papers is to set out some illustrations, sort of illustrative examples as to how we would expect the standard to be applied. And obviously we're speaking to, we're going to be getting the interpretation committee members' inputs and views on that. And identifying, you know, is there additional clarification, additional guidance, such as publishing illustrative examples that perhaps we could do to help people with this? Because you're right, and we've heard this through the outreach that we've done as well, that there is diversity, there is uncertainty about how to apply these new requirements.
Well, it's simple. Was the intention, go back to the impact analysis, was the intention to change the service cost or not? And we've believed initially that the intention of IAS 19 was not to change the calculation of service cost, and now people are telling us, well, because of this wording that you've moved from the gross service cost to the net service cost to the company, it actually changes the service cost for the company. So, and we are even, I was actually one of the people that I was speaking to last Friday, actually it's based here in the UK, and apparently even there are perhaps more plans. Initially it was thought it was only an issue for Switzerland and certain Dutch plans, but it actually seems to be more pervasive. So again, if your intention when you issued IAS 19 was not to change the calculation of service cost, you could just say that, and then we all, you know, the service cost for the company.
I'd agree. I think it touches on one, another issue that IFRIC faces, and two, there's probably might be a way around this.
Bill, do you mind speak up a little bit?
Sorry, two things. First of all, it's been identified that IFRIC isn't good at dealing with urgent issues, and as Malcolm said, this is a fairly urgent issue. So it may be too late now to do it urgently, but it's another reminder of that particular issue. Secondly, his point that it may be quite easy to clarify, you have done that in other standards through, so IAS 37, in your discussion on the recent issues on levies, you made a statement that it is the last event in the series of a chain of events that is the obligating event for IAS 37. That's a clarification of IAS 37. Okay, so you've done it. You've been there, the genie's out of the bottle. So that might be a way of, you know, clarifying that you weren't intending to change the service cost, and that might get Malcolm and his colleagues to the place they want to be, if your intention was to change the service cost interface.
Michael, is this, I apologize, I did not look at the tomorrow's agenda, the after tomorrow's. Is this on the agenda?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Any wisdom you can impart whether there will be any decision based on the previous experience? Just to alleviate some concerns. I'm not asking you to look into the crystal ball, which is not possible.
Yes. Well, obviously, I always hope that the Interpretations Committee will agree with our staff recommendations on these things. But even if they don't, you know, if they've got a different point of view, then that's helpful as well, because, you know, we can then head down that particular route. There's, I guess, two aspects to all of these issues, and that is, first of all, what is the technical answer? And then the second is, once we've got that, what's the most expedient and efficient way of getting it out and getting it in a way that's helpful for people? Now, if it's a case of we're seeking to give additional guidance and clarification on what is already required, then that can be achieved in a number of ways, for which the due process can be shorter than if we're actually changing the requirements of the standards, where it requires a longer due process. So there are, you know, depending on what the answer is in terms of the conclusions from the committee, then that can help us determine which direction to go.
I just want a straight answer by the end of the week.
Noted. We are aware of the pension issue, and especially in Switzerland.
But and it's I'm actually sure. more pervasive. We realise it's not actually.
But you guys started the noise.
We started the noise some actually best part of the year ago.
Fair. Anything else you want to share with us and get beaten up, Michael? Or
well. No, I don't know that there's anything in particular. I'm happy to take any questions on the other issues that I've not touched on, or if you've got other questions about what the committee is looking at or you think should be looking at.
We are eating into April, but let us, with the due permission from April, let's spend another 5 minutes and stop, have a hard stop at 2 o'clock. So the 2 to 2:45 will be April's presentation. So we'll eat 15 minutes of our time. So you have 5 more minutes of bonus to see if you need anything else from the committee.
Okay.
I hope you will pass on these comments to the chairman also. It's Upton.
I will. I suppose just one thing. I mean, yes, the timing and the time that it takes to take things through due process is a factor that, you know, we can't short circuit that. And so I suppose as soon as, and Malcolm, I appreciate you mentioned that you know, things started to be raised about this best part of a year ago. And do, you know, do please bring things to our attention as soon as you see them. You know, contact me or one of the other directors, and you know, maybe we could have a meeting or a conference call to talk about the issue. Let's get a submission in quickly, because obviously the sooner that we can get it into the process, then the sooner that we can bring a resolution.
Just for my consumption, this pension issue that Malcolm raised said a year ago, the submission came from whom? You don't need to tell the particular company or anything, but is it from the auditors or is it from the preparers?
I'm not sure who actually puts out. Some actuaries? I'm not sure who approved.
Trying to think whether it's public or not, and I just honestly can't remember whether it's public or not, so I would rather not say just now. But I think the formal submission came in sometime over the summer.
Yeah,
that's so sort of July time, something like that.
But we've been kicking it around since the springtime.
Yes. I think that goes to the Michael's point that the sooner you can at least get him onto the conference call, it will be helpful.
Yes.
That's the point I'm driving at. Yeah. Anything else?
Okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Right. Thanks. Thank you.
go ahead. I think.